This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Ida B. Wells was a force in the battle against racial injustice. She sued and won a lawsuit against a railroad for ejecting her from a train for refusing to move to a segregated car for blacks. As a young teacher, she was fired for protesting conditions in the segregated schools of Memphis. She took up journalism. She launched a crusade against lynching. What made her a leader? That's the question we'll take up this afternoon. Our guest is historian James West Davidson. He is the author most recently of They Say, Ida B. Wells and the Reconstruction of Race. In the prologue to this book, Davidson says Wells, quoting here, came of age as one of that first generation of African Americans in the years following emancipation. In that sense, the first three decades of her life reflected the uncertain and uncharted path many were following to discover what it meant to be a free black woman in Victorian America. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, James West Davidson, is a historian and writer. His books include After the Fact, The Art of Historical Detection, and Nation of Nations, A History of the American Republic. His book, They Say, Ida B. Wells and the Reconstruction of Race, is published by Oxford University Press. It is one of the titles in the Oxford series, New Narratives in American History. I look forward to your phone calls, listeners, for our guest, James West Davidson, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Davidson, welcome. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. At the outset of the book, in the prologue, there are a couple of photos. Actually, what I'm thinking of here is the same photo. The first time we see it, we're looking at a photo that has been cropped. What do we see in that cropped photo?
Well, there's about 40 or 50 people standing on a bridge over the Okima River in Oklahoma in 1910. And you can see that it's quite a diverse group. There are older folks. There are well-to-do. There are ladies dressed up with their fine bonnets on, and some of them carrying children. There's a couple who are bare feet, perhaps barefooted, standing on one of the rails of the bridge, and they are all getting ready to have their picture taken.
And what do we see when we see the entire photo?
Well, when you see the entire photo, what you discover is that this group that is out having their picture taken, if you move back and see the entire bridge and the river itself, there are two African Americans who have been lynched and are hanging suspended by nooses from the bridge. And this word had gotten out that there had been a lynching, and all these people came. And I guess what kind of shocked me was that when I was growing up, I knew about these sort of postcards in the most general sense. My great aunt used to collect these tinted pictures of her vacations in Miami and so forth. And this was sort of in that same vein, a kind of postcard, nostalgic postcard from the turn of the century. But in this case, it was of a horrific event, and what shocked me when I came to it was that it was not only horrific, but these people on the bridge were clearly quite happy to have their picture taken, and were looking out at the photographer, had posed, and often had little children there that they brought along. So it sort of hit me, I don't know, like a 2x4 across the chest, as a sign that things were different at the turn of the century, probably could be considered in terms of American history to be the nadir of race relations. But this sort of drove that point home in a very visceral way.
Yeah. Late in the book, you say buying and sending these postcards were acts of definition. I suppose also being part of the scene, being in the photo, was an act of definition as well. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is, again, we have to put ourselves back in that period. And postcards at that point, and photography itself, less photography itself, but postcards were a kind of new innovation. And, you know, when the original photography began with daguerreotypes in the 1840s and 50s and 60s, you would sit for portraits, often, you know, wearing neck braces because the exposures were so long that they didn't want you to jiggle. And so that in the late 19th century, with the innovations of Eastman Kodak, all of a sudden you had the ability to take much more candid shots and shots that were on location. But if you look at the postcards of this era, and in fact many of them are still available, the actual cards from those days on eBay, and two of the postcards I published there, not the one of the lynching, but of other scenes, are ones that I bought myself on eBay, sort of browsing through. And what happened was that they made these postcards so that you could take photographs, and Kodak had the great idea of putting on the back a place for a stamp and place for an address. So now you could go to a city or town and not simply say, oh, I'll get this postcard of Coney Island, but you could get yourself photographed and mail that off as a postcard. So in a way, you are defining yourself more so than we would think of today with photographs, although we still, you know, when you sit up for a portrait or you're with a group, obviously, you know, you're thinking about how you look. But even more so at the turn of the century, people are sort of defining themselves, and clearly for these people, this was part of their self-definition, that this was not anything that they were upset about. This was an event that happened. And since the book that I wrote, I was fascinated by Ida Wells' attempt to define herself in an era where there were such ferocious headwinds. And so it seemed to me that starting with these postcards was one way for us in the 21st century mm-hmm. to enter back into that mindset and to see how everybody is defining themselves.
Yeah. What do you think it says that there is interest in these postcards of lynchings in the 21st century?
Well,
other than for historical purposes.
For historical purposes, you know, I guess there is, you know, some sort of market. I should stress that on, you know, I've never seen any lynching postcards per se on eBay, but certainly, you know, these postcards are available, and a book was published in, I think it's 2001, called Without Sanctuary, which was by a collector, a scholarly collector, who had begun to discover the existence of these cards and began to collect them, and it's a very sensitively done book. But I think certainly, you know, those, I think the cards are probably now pretty hard to, you know, to find yeah. anywhere on open markets. But you know, there's still plenty of other things that are worrisome about.
Well, I ask, and I don't want to get off too much into this, but I ask in light of the recent spate of incidents involving nooses.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was where I was sort of leading to, because it really, in the past week or two, beyond, of course, the incident at Gina, Louisiana, where nooses were hung
mm-hmm.
A year ago now, it was, although it took a while for that to percolate. But, you know, clearly, I was thinking this morning about, you know, where Ida Wells would stand today. And on the one hand, you read in the news accounts, gee, there's been a lot of progress. You know, the controversy at Gina was over the hanging of nooses and not actual lynchings. And while lynchings have not entirely disappeared, they certainly are much less common. But this the nooses that have proliferated in what some people are wondering, are they, you know, partly copycat crimes? But it's not simply to copy something. Obviously, there are still sentiments there, and I think if we look at the reaction to them, you do see a very divided citizenry. You know, I have some people who say, "Oh my gosh, you know, these are just nuisance boys playing pranks." But it's very hard when you look at the history of what Wells lived through in that era to see this as sort of innocent pranks when you begin to delve into it.
Yeah. Well, why? Also, I think it is interesting is because it's an act, and it could, you could say, it's an act.
Self-definition.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
exactly.
That's right. And, you know, it is really saying, in a way, if you analyze, and there are different circumstances from place to place and incident to incident, but one of the things that Wells really discovered as she was drawn into her career as a social activist, which is not the way she started out her life intending to do this, but as she got drawn in, she began to see that the motivations that are involved here are often, you know, quite baldly, in one sense, economic. That there is a threat that blacks pose. And if you look at the where these nooses have popped up, they're often in construction sites or where, for instance, a African American police officer is promoted to deputy chief, and these are clearly signs of intimidation, it seems to me. You begin to go out, edge out a little farther into, there have been just in the last couple of days, I've noticed a couple of issues popping up about Halloween displays, where there are, in addition to the black cats and the skeletons and so on, somebody has placed an effigy and of you know, a noose and someone hanging there, and whether it's Black Halloween sometimes or whether it's actually meant to be a Black African American is not always clear, but still we're at a borderline where clearly people at the very least seem to have a certain amnesia about the history of our past.
Mm. Well, let's go back now to the past, to 1862, July 16th. That's when Ida B. Wells was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi. She was born a couple of months before Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation.
Indeed. It struck me that this was a very interesting coincidence because, in a way, it marks her out as being among that first generation of freedmen, as they were called back then, of the freed slaves. I guess technically she probably was a slave for the first few months of her life. But, you know, it struck me that here's a woman who is growing up in these first decades of her life are the first decades of freedom for, you know, 4 million or so former slaves, and all of the people are involved in trying to figure out for themselves what does it mean now to be free. And in one sense, that seems like an easy question to answer, but in that transition after the Emancipation Proclamation and in the years beyond to freedom from slavery, it's an immensely complicated question in terms of anything from the large issues of school and career and political participation to the simple act of walking down the street. All these things are affected by what it means to be free, and it's at that point unclear. What is it going to mean?
Yeah. What did race mean at that point?
Well, interesting. Certainly race was a factor, and race had been a factor in American history throughout, you know, it's 400 years since, you know, the earliest colonial settlements. But in one sense, I think that we don't always realize today, race was less important than this legal concept of slavery. That is, you had that definition if you, you know, you were either a slave or you were free. If you were a slave, there were a whole set of codes and laws and behaviors expected of you. And suddenly, with emancipation, that legal definition, and again, we're talking about definition now, of individuals, is swept away. Now there is no way that you can say, okay, you're a slave, you have to behave like this. Everyone is free. So in such a situation, if you are uneasy or unhappy about you know, freedom for African Americans and trying to adjust, what do you have to separate yourself from African Americans to keep them in their former position of slavery? And race really, therefore, becomes much more important. And part of what is interesting to me is that we're watching over these next 30 years as Ida Wells is growing up like so many other African Americans, looking to be free, to be independent, and make her own way. At the same time, race as a concept is becoming more and more important in terms of trying to define and to act as a barrier to advancement. Now that slavery is gone, race becomes much more important.
Yeah. And that's the heartbreak, I think, early in the story of Jim Wells, mm-hmm. her dad. James Wells, her father, Elizabeth, Lizzie, her mom. Jim Wells, after the war was over and there was freedom for slaves, he got involved in politics. Why were politics important to him? How did he get involved?
Well, exactly. You know, it was important to, you know, take control. And if you're going to be free, one of the things that you had was the vote, participation in political life. And even in the Civil War, before freedom came, there were agents passing through, often secretly, spreading word of what some people call the four L's. Lincoln's, it got boiled down to the Loyal League, Lincoln's Loyal League, and the Union League, as others called it, but was a group that tried to mobilize, partly as a political arm of the Republican Party, which knew that it needed black support in the New South after the Civil War, but partly with great excitement on the part of African Americans that here was a chance to join, and it was a fraternal order, and had branches in, you know, in cities and towns all across the South, and often officers from the Union Army, the famous sort of carpetbaggers, as the Southerners derisively referred to them, who came down to the South, might well be candidates in a village, as in Holly Springs, where Ida grew up. There was a fellow who led the Union League, the Loyal League, and Jim Wells, you know, would have joined with other blacks, and you can read, again, there's not much information in the particular case of Holly Springs, but we do know there was a Loyal League there, and we do get occasional mentions of the groups coming out to drill as militia, and other times to meet politically, and we do have information, again, from Confederate sympathizers at the turn of the century, writing with a good deal of disdain for the Loyal League, but talking about really what is remarkable, sort of a surge of political participation, where in downtown Holly Springs there would be parades and beaches, and you would wear your loyalty caps and red sashes, and on horseback would march through the town, sometimes the parades were the day. Even more significant in some ways were the torchlight parades at night, which were a part of American electioneering. It had been all through the 19th century, torchlight parades with these transparencies. You would have these linen paintings that would be oiled and varnished, so they're almost like transparent slides, and in the light of torches they would glow, and you can see the images, and these would be part of the parades too. And what made them especially, I think, exciting for newly freed African Americans and fearsome for many white Southerners was that during the era of slavery, the night had been something that was in effect denied to slaves. You were not supposed to be out at night during the slavery era, and there were patrollers, white patrollers, who would patrol the roads to make sure people weren't sneaking around. So you could be whipped and in big trouble if you were caught out. All of a sudden, here after the war, here are these in Holly Springs, over 1,000 people marching in parades that sometimes went as long as a mile, marching through the street in the middle of the night with torches. This is really quite exciting, and Jim Wells, of course, was excited about it. And one of Ida's earliest memories is her mother at home with Ida being very nervous and pacing the floor until Jim Wells came home safely from some of these meetings.
Yeah, that political activity could be dangerous.
Yeah.
In less than 10 years then, though, Reconstruction was over. I think, if I'm recalling correctly from the book, the first state election that African-American men were able to vote in was 1871, and then, boom, it's gone.
By 1871, right, or, I'm sorry, 1877, the presidential election ends up with Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican, remaining in office in that contested election, the closest one since Gore v. Bush in 2000, with a deal which allowed Hayes to squeak in, but only with the understanding that in the South, those political forces of the Democrats, which were dedicated to redeeming the South, as they put it, the Redeemers, were allowed to take charge, and the North more or less agreed to say, hands off, laissez-faire, you go your own way. And the elections running up to 1876, 1875, the intimidation begins. That's when you first, in these years, is of course when the Ku Klux Klan begins to ride, so yes, it's a fairly brief window of opportunity. There's still on a kind of local level from about 1865, 1866 during Reconstruction. It takes Mississippi a while to write a constitution, so the first election that Jim Wells votes in is 1871, I believe, but it really is a fairly short time before the white Southerners manage to clamp down and eliminate a great deal, not entirely, but if you look at the election totals between 1871, 1872, suddenly in 1875, 1876, only a tenth of blacks are voting because they're intimidated.
Did the political involvement and ultimately the political disappointment of Jim Wells, did that make an impression on young Ida?
I can't help but think it did. She does not explicitly, her autobiography, which is a wonderful and interesting document, but the number of pages devoted to growing up, is very slender, so that she does not spend a lot of time talking about this, but clearly she admired her father immensely. She always spoke of him with fondness, and she remembers him being proud of her ability to read. And whether it's not clear. Lizzie certainly learned to read. It's not clear whether Jim Wells did. He may have. We just don't know. A lot of African Americans after the war were very involved in education, but clearly he was so proud of her, he did follow the newspapers, and whether he read or had read to him the headlines and the stories, he certainly kept up with political events, and he loved it when she got to be old enough at 4 or 5 years old that she could begin to read out of the newspapers. Mm-hmm. He'd get his friends in and say, "Now look at this, Ida Reed, you know." Yeah. It was a big thing.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, later in life, she would champion suffrage for women, too. So,
absolutely.
So it had to, you can kind of suppose.
Clearly, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Clearly she did. And clearly, you know, there was a grit. When you went to vote, today we're used to the secret ballot. But in those days, you had these tickets, these ballot tickets, and indeed, they were painted or printed in different colors to help you, help people who couldn't read sometimes. You'd know that the Republican ticket, if you were voting Republican, that was the red one with the tiger on it. And so when you went to drop your vote in, the election officers could often see how you were voting. And so what would happen was Jim Wells' employer, who was a Democrat, had told him in the first election, made no secret. He said, you should be voting Democratic. And Wells was going to have none of this. Jim Wells went and voted Republican, and clearly somebody there at the polls, we don't know if his employer was there, actually probably wasn't, but by the time Jim Wells finished voting and got back to his tool house, he was a carpenter working for this employer, white employer. By the time he'd gotten home, obviously his employer had found out about it, and Wells came home and his shop was locked up. He was locked out, basically fired. And, you know, one course of action would be, in a case like this, is to, you know, say, things are getting a little hot here. Let's pack our bags and leave. I'm out of a job. Let's go move and find somewhere else to work. And he did nothing of the sort. He went downtown. He bought a new set of carpenter's tools that he would own himself, and rented a house a few doors down across the street. And that's not quite like thumbing your nose at your employer, but it was pretty brash. I mean, he was a fellow who was not going to get moved out of town just because his employer fired him for not voting the right way.
Hmm. James West Davidson is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Ida B. Wells and the Reconstruction of Race. That's James West Davidson's subtitle for his book, They Say, Ida B. Wells and the Reconstruction of Race. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a couple of calls now. A listener first in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I don't know if I have this right, but was Ida B. Wells one of the journalists that did some muckraking against Standard Oil, or am I thinking of somebody else?
That's actually Ida Tarbell.
Oh, Tarbell.
Another
oh,
Ida. Popular name back then.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana. Line 1. Hi.
Hi. This is a really good program. But I want to ask the historian, as a historian, what he thinks about Ida B. Wells' autobiography. One of her more recent biographers is a little dismissive of that book, and it bothers me because I think there's some valuable historical information in it. But the other person argues that Ida B. Wells is so, self-defensive. She's very subjective about herself, which is, of course, all autobiographers are. But I've always wanted to ask another historian's opinion about Crusade for Justice.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting issue you touch on. Ida Wells, or in later years, Ida Wells Barnett, after she married, was certainly one element of her personality was a stubbornness and a determination always to do what she thought was right. Her mother, again, was influential in bringing her up in this way. And that led sometimes to very little patience on her part toward other people when she did not agree about what tactics to use politically in advancing the cause of freedom and civil rights. And so she is often defensive in a way in her autobiography because she did, as the years went on, just reading back at one of those points, she says to herself, well, temper is often my besetting sin. But I certainly don't dismiss that. I think it's a fascinating autobiography, and certainly there are places where, as a historian, we know that when we try to recollect earlier times in life, there are places where there may be a date that is slightly off, but with good foot, often they're corrected in the autobiography or other biographers have collected. But one of the things that I think is important in understanding Wells, which comes across not only in her biography, but another wonderful document, which is her diary from the 1880s, when she's the autobiography is written in the last years of her life, and sort of takes that attitude. But if you look at also her diary that she wrote while living in Memphis in her mid-20s, it's another wonderful way to contrast the two voices of the young Ida and the old Ida. And I think, as I began to think about this question of, Wells Barnett and temperament, and, sometimes she's defensive because she was often, in quarrels or set tos with other reformers, I think part of the personality is the fact that she really did have this moral sense of rightness from her mother. And it was, as I say, the low point in race relations probably in the entire history of the country, and there were not a lot of easy solutions. And I think Wells was able to see that when she identified lynching as a way to maintain the color line, as she would put it, to make sure that one drop rule, as they called it, if you have one drop of black blood, you're black, and that color line puts you on the other side, and you can't move across that. And if you try to, lynching is going to stop you. And whether it's economic or whether it's having, falling in love with a person of the opposite sex, especially if it was a black man falling in love with a white woman, that was crossing a tabooed boundary. And a lot of people at the turn of the century, like Booker T. Washington, were saying, the way we've got to make progress is to accommodate. And Washington famously gives his speech, known now as the Atlanta Compromise, that says, if we work hard and forget about politics for the time being, just work hard and be good and, save money and don't push yourself too hard into the political arena, we will gradually come to be accepted. And Wells' vision came to be. She agreed with this for many years, but especially after 1893 and the lynching that sort of pushed her into a more full-fledged campaign against lynching, she came to see that if lynching was indeed not something that was simply outrage against crimes that had been committed by this black person or that person, but if it was instead something that was designed to hold you back, then her interpretation of the situation was, no matter how polite you try to be, how hard you work, there is going to be that line, and that's what lynching is about, to make sure you stay on that other side of that line. And therefore, when it was, I think, very frustrating for her when people would say, well, we've got to compromise. She was someone who did not see compromise, and I think saw clearly enough so that her you know, the fact that she felt so strongly often did get her into arguments with others. But I do think the autobiography is very much worth reading.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I agree with totally. I was just thinking about reliability.
Yeah, just the point of...
Well, I know her daughter edited it and corrected the dates and footnotes.
Right,
that
right.
part I know, but I was thinking about where she puts herself at certain points. Saying, for example, that she was there at the founding of the NAACP, but was not invited because she had an argument with someone, so she wasn't invited to be a part of the steering committee or something to that.
Right, right.
You know, so it just fits with what you're saying. But, you know, when you see pictures of that group of people who founded the NAACP, she's not in it, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, so, that's right. That's
it's
right.
Those kinds of little details in her book that some of my students raise questions about. You know, I happen to think she was there myself, but,
yeah.
you know, I always tell them, well, that doesn't matter. She was clearly a friend of Du Bois, and she was aware of the need for a national watchdog organization like the NAACP. So if she appears in a photograph or not, I don't think that's a reason to say her whole book is a lie, you know, as a
Absolutely.
Lie.
Absolutely. No,
so that's
no.
just...
That's right. That's right.
That's from a recent experience I had teaching her book, Crusade for Justice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Okay. Well, I'll hang up and give others a chance, but this is very interesting.
Great.
Thank you.
Nice to talk.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 2 in Champaign County. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to know what in her writings about the campaign against lynching, whether she talked about it as... you said keeping a person on the right side of the line. I'm looking at a book by Elliot Jaspin subtitled The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America, and he's like a computer journalist, and he it's actually titled Buried in Bitter Waters. And just there's this write-up on it on History News Network, and he did a statistical analysis of county by county across the whole country and found that there were what he called collapses in the black population, and that he basically, I'm just wondering whether in her contemporaneous writing about lynching, she talks much about how it was used as a way of cleansing, you know, areas. And I think it's contemporaneous with Gina. Gina is a rural area where you would expect an agricultural population to be there, and it has 7% African American. It was, I think, it was clearly it was a cleansed district along the lines of what this guy is suggesting. And I'm just wondering, in contemporaneous writings, you find that kind of scenario: the Klan keeps them out. You know, that kind of line.
Yeah.
Maybe it's so commonplace, but I find it astonishing it isn't talked more as an explicit policy. He says it ran from the 1890s to the, you know, to the 1940s and 50s, that this kind of intimidation. There's a famous town in Florida that was burnt down, I guess. People know about that, but this was systematic, apparently. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that book, and I guess it might depend on how far of you know what that means in terms of cleansing. You know, we get into definitions of, you know, ethnic cleansing today, where people are actually going out and killed, and obviously lynching did do that. But in terms of, you know, in terms of most crudely, I guess, population control. I mean, your second point was whether it's keeping black folk say from coming to an area, as opposed to, you know, say murder as a social policy. I'm not quite sure where this fellow was on that line. The estimates of the lynching are hard to hard to come by accurately, because dependent on people like Wells and other journalists sort of finding and picking out incidences. Some were very well publicized, and others were not at all. But I mean, we're talking about the number of lynchings. A common estimate is maybe 3,300 from, I think, say 1890 through 1930, which is a horrendous number, but it is not a, you know, it's a drop in the bucket in terms of a larger question of population control. And you also have the issue of economic, different economic interests as to who wants, let's say, African American labor around. In Gina, as I understand, I'm certainly no expert on Gina, but my understanding is that this was part of traditionally the timber industry, and so that economic factors over the years have driven out, as often happened in the South in the 1920s and then the 1950s, as cotton picking was increasingly mechanized. There is a large migration out of the South toward the northern cities like Chicago and New York, many other cities. And so, you know, I think I don't think Wells would see this as a population issue in terms of population control. I guess it would be more a social intimidation and keeping a labor source which was limiting education. And what's interesting about Wells is she's someone who kind of dreams the dream, because she is, you know, she's not a field worker. She, you know, from an early age, she's read the Bible from cover to cover, partly because Lizzie was so devout she wouldn't let, on the Sabbath, her family read anything but the Bible. So Wells was a voracious reader, had nothing else to do. So, I mean, not that she didn't, she was very devout, so she was quite happy to read the Bible, but, you know, read Shakespeare, all the works of Shakespeare. And she was a very, you know, educated person, and wanted a life that beyond sort of being just a field hand. And so I think, you know, there was this economic element and cultural, you know, in terms of how can we define yourselves. And at the time, race was being used to define down African Americans as people who, you know, who were primitive, too close to their African ancestry, and I mean, you can go on. All the, but you know, all the articles supposedly scientific in the Atlantic Monthly and Harper's by graduates of Harvard, and this was the main line that she was fighting against. And so I think it was more of along those lines than perhaps a campaign of extermination.
Yeah, we have to wrap it up here.
I'm sorry,
now.
Yes.
And I'm sorry to say that, because there's so much here. There are a number of really interesting galvanizing events in her life in her first 30 years that we haven't really talked about, because there's just so much here.
So much there,
but,
yeah.
But I do want to ask you, in terms of her writing, from her days with the Memphis paper, Free Speech,
mm-hmm.
Through her lectures and on, and pretty much you're interested in the first 30 years of her life. And in 1892, we see this big moment in Memphis, the Curve Riot and the lynching that followed. And this really fuels her. I mean, already we see that she's a tenacious, talented, driven woman with a solid moral core. But in terms of from 1892 then on, can you just, by summing up here, give us an idea of the effect her writings and her lectures had on the white American world?
Right. I think that's one reason that she ends up sort of focusing in her later years on more local issues. Partly also she has a family for a while that brings her, she gets married in 1895, and so sort of has to balance the traditional feminist dilemma of career and family. But, you know, she manages in the 1890s to become well known as the black community of the time referred to her as the Joan of Arc of her people. And she was tremendously effective in rallying people. The white community, I mean, it was very discouraging. She did finally gain recognition with her lecture tours. She went to Britain, and ironically, it was only when she went to Britain and started touring around there where sometimes crowds of 1,000 or more would come to churches to hear her, and always impressed at her ability at speaking. And then the American newspapers, including, you know, the paper of record, the New York Times, and many others who had ignored her, all of a sudden, now that she's getting publicity in England, they begin to pay more attention. And there was progress that she made. I mean, both in Memphis, her hometown, it became less easy to flagrantly justify lynchings, yeah. But she made some progress, but it was such a headwind. She ended up concentrating more locally for the later part of her life in Chicago.
Yeah, there we have to leave it.
Yes.
Forgive me for butting in there,
yeah.
But
quite all right.
James West Davidson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a writer and a historian. He is the author, most recently, of They Say, Ida B. Wells and the Reconstruction of Race. The book is published by Oxford University Press. It's one of the titles in the Oxford series, New Narratives in American History.